Picture yourself at cruise altitude. Sky is clear, visibility is unlimited, and you're about 45 minutes from your destination. You did your pre-flight, you sumped the tanks, you know you have enough fuel. And then, without warning, the engine stumbles. Not sputters like it's hot and unhappy, it stumbles. Like someone reached in and took something away from it, then it catches, then it stumbles again, and then it goes quiet. You have fuel. You know you have fuel. So what just happened? I'm Pattern, and this is Traffic Pattern on Radio Hangar. Today we're talking about fuel starvation, not fuel exhaustion, which is when you actually run out of gas, fuel starvation, which is when the engine can't get to the fuel that's sitting right there in your tanks. And it kills people every year. Pilots who did their pre-flight, who planned carefully, who had enough fuel to reach their destination and then some, and the engine quit anyway. Before we dig into the mechanics of this, a quick shout out to our friends at AviationSoul.com. They make challenge coins for every step of the pilot journey. First solo, private certificate, instrument, commercial, coins that mark the milestones that actually mean something to a pilot. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Okay, so let's talk about what fuel starvation actually is, because the name is a little misleading. Fuel exhaustion means you ran out of fuel. Simple. You miscalculated, you didn't fuel up, you flew longer than you planned, and eventually both tanks hit empty and the engine quit. That's one problem, and it's mostly a planning and discipline problem. Fuel starvation is different. Fuel starvation means there is fuel in the airplane, it is sitting in your tanks, but it is not reaching the engine. The engine is starving for fuel that exists in the airplane. And that distinction matters enormously, because the emergency response for starvation is very different from the response for exhaustion.
The National Transportation Safety Board has looked at general aviation accidents for decades, and fuel-related engine failures are consistently among the top causes of fatal accidents. Some analyses put fuel management errors at accounting for somewhere around 11 to 12% of all engine failures in general aviation, and a significant portion of those are starvation, not exhaustion, meaning pilots with fuel in the airplane who could not get it to the engine in time. So how does fuel starvation happen? Let me walk through the most common causes, because understanding the mechanism is the first step to both preventing it and fixing it. The most common cause, the one that shows up in accident reports over and over again, is the fuel selector. In a lot of training aircraft, particularly the Cessna 172 and Piper Cherokee line, you have a fuel selector valve that lets you choose which tank you're drawing from, left tank, right tank, or in some aircraft, both. In the Cherokee and several other Pipers, the selector has four positions: left, right, both, and off. Off. There is an off position on the fuel selector valve, and it is adjacent to the other positions, and people have accidentally moved the selector to off during flight, during a fuel check, during turbulence, during a moment of inattention. They meant to switch to the other tank and went past it to off, and the engine quit. In a Cessna 172, the selector has only two main positions, left and right. But the issue there is different. You can run one tank very low by not switching tanks on schedule. The engine starts to stumble because that tank is nearly empty. You have fuel in the other tank, but you have got to get the selector moved and give the fuel system a moment to respond before the engine picks back up.
Here is something I wish someone told me when I was training. The Cessna 172 and Piper Cherokee are different animals when it comes to fuel management. The Cherokee draws from one tank at a time. If you leave it on the left tank for 2 hours, the left tank is going to be significantly lower than the right. If you then try to land with that low tank and the fuel sloshes away from the outlet, you can get momentary starvation even with fuel remaining. This is called fuel port uncovering. You have got fuel in the tank, but because of the aircraft's attitude or the angle of a turn, the fuel is not covering the tank outlet. The Cherokee is particularly known for this during prolonged slipping turns. Some pilots have reported partial power loss in long slips when the active tank is running low. Not something that will bite you when your tanks are full. Very much something that can bite you in the later stages of a long flight. The Cessna handles fuel differently. The 172 draws from both tanks simultaneously when the selector is on the both position. That minimizes imbalance but introduces its own quirk, and there are specific loading and attitude conditions where starvation can still catch you off guard. Beyond the selector, there are other causes worth knowing. Fuel contamination can block the system. Water in the fuel sinks to the bottom and concentrates in the sumps. It can get into the lines and restrict flow. This is why we sump the tanks and the gascolator before every flight, not as a ritual, as an actual check. You are looking for water, which shows up as droplets or a cloudy layer in your fuel sample.
You're looking for debris. You're looking at the color. 100 Lowliat Avgas is blue. If you're looking at something that does not look right, it is not right.
A blocked fuel vent is another one. Your fuel tanks have vents that allow air to replace the fuel as it burns. If that vent gets blocked, you create a partial vacuum in the tank as the fuel level drops. The fuel stops flowing because the physics will not let it. A tank that cannot vent will gradually starve the engine. You will see this as a gradual power loss that worsens over time, not a sudden stoppage. And then there are cases of a fuel cap that was not seated properly after fueling. This can create a similar venting problem, or in extreme cases, you can lose fuel in flight through an improperly sealed cap. Now let me add one more for the pilots transitioning to fuel-injected engines. Vapor lock in hot conditions, particularly after a brief shutdown on a warm summer day, fuel in the injector lines of a fuel-injected engine can vaporize. When you go to restart, you are cranking against vapor instead of liquid fuel. The engine turns and turns and nothing catches. This is the classic hot start situation in a Lycoming fuel-injected engine, and it is a form of temporary starvation. The fuel system cannot deliver liquid fuel until the vapor is purged. The hot start procedure is counterintuitive. You typically open the throttle well beyond where you would for a normal start, move the mixture to cutoff, engage the starter to crank the engine and purge vapor through the system, and once the engine catches, quickly advance the mixture to rich. Some pilots prime the system by running the boost pump briefly before cranking. The exact procedure varies by manufacturer and engine variant. So reading your pilot's operating handbook before this situation finds you is not optional. Practice the hot start procedure while the engine is still warm. Do not be caught guessing on a hot ramp with passengers. Let's talk about what fuel starvation feels like in the cockpit, because this is where your situational awareness has to be sharp. In most cases, you will not get a sudden silence. You will get a warning. The engine will stumble. You might feel a slight loss of power, a roughness, almost like a magneto miss. If you are watching your instruments, you might see RPM fall. You might see fuel flow drop. In a carbureted engine, the manifold pressure might waver. This stumble phase is the fuel system running low in the float bowl, catching briefly, running low again. The engine is trying to work with what it has. It is giving you a chance to react. Your reaction time in this window matters enormously. If you catch it in the stumble phase and immediately switch tanks and hit the boost pump, the engine may recover before it quits entirely. If you wait or if you're not sure what is happening, the engine will quit. At that point, you are in a forced landing scenario and you're diagnosing the problem with a lot less time and altitude. So what do you do? Fuel selector first. Switch to the fullest tank or to both if your aircraft has that option. This is your first move. Get fuel flowing from a tank that has fuel boost pump on. Most training aircraft have an electric boost pump. Turn it on. You are supplementing the engine-driven pump and helping push fuel through the system. Mixture to rich. If you have been leaning at altitude, bring it back to full rich. You want maximum fuel flow right now. Carburetor heat on if you have a carbureted engine. This is a secondary step, but carb ice can mimic starvation symptoms. If ice is the culprit, carb heat will clear it. You might lose a little RPM when you first apply carb heat, then recover as the ice clears. That recovery tells you ice was part of the picture, and you're already looking for a place to land. Even if the engine recovers, treat an unexplained power loss as a warning. You have a reason to get on the ground soon. Do not push on to your destination if something went wrong. Land. Get the aircraft inspected. Understand what happened. If the engine has fully quit, your best glide speed is your immediate response. Pitch for it and hold it. In a Cessna 172, that is roughly 65 knots. In a Piper Cherokee 180, about 75 knots. Know your number before you leave the ground. Have it memorized. Then you are troubleshooting. Fuel selector to the other tank. Boost pump on. Mixture rich. Carb heat on. Check the primer. Check the throttle. And if the engine has not restarted in a reasonable amount of time, you're selecting your landing area and flying the airplane. The Airman Certification Standards tasks you with demonstrating an emergency approach and landing. The examiner is looking for whether you maintain aircraft control first, then attempt to determine the cause, then execute a safe off-airport landing. Not the other way around, the sequence matters. Flying the airplane is always first. An examiner will fail a student who gets so focused on restarting the engine that they let the airspeed bleed off, and the options below them disappear.
Let me give you a scenario that illustrates how quickly this can go sideways. Imagine a student pilot on a solo cross-country, cruising at 4,500 feet, following their nav log, making good time. An hour and 45 minutes into the flight, they have been on the left tank since they departed. They should have switched about 45 minutes ago, but they forgot. The engine starts to stumble. They do not recognize it immediately as fuel starvation, because they have never experienced it. They think maybe it is turbulence. Maybe they are hearing things. The stumble gets worse. Now the engine quits. They remember ground school, airspeed, best glide. They remember the fuel selector, switch to the right tank, hit the boost pump, the engine catches and comes back up. They get to their destination, land shaking, and call their instructor. That is the good outcome. The engine came back because there was fuel in the other tank, and because they eventually got to the right procedure. But there is a version of that scenario where the stumble phase passes faster than they react, or where the terrain below offers no good landing options, or where the panic wins and the selector does not get switched in time. The goal in training is to make the response automatic enough that panic does not win. You drill emergency procedures not because emergencies are common, but because when they happen, you do not have time to think, you have time to react. And what you react with is what you have practiced. So, build the habits before you need them. Switch tanks on a schedule. Every 30 minutes per side is a common starting point for aircraft that draw from one tank at a time. Set a timer if you need to. Do not rely on your sense of time during a cross country. When you switch tanks, verbalize it. Left tank. Right tank. Say it out loud. Then verify the position by feel and by sight. In a busy or stressful phase of flight, a verbal call-out engages a different part of your attention than just flipping a switch. Sump every tank every time. Pull a real sample. Give yourself enough fuel to actually look at it. And during your descent and approach checklist, verify the fuel selector position. It is on almost every checklist for a reason. It is your defense against inattention during the most demanding phase of the flight. Finally, know your airplane's fuel system. Not just that fuel goes in the wing. Know how it feeds, where the selector is, where the vent is, where the gascoilator is, and how fuel actually travels from the tank to the engine. For most training aircraft, this is a 30-minute read through the pilot's operating handbook. That 30 minutes could be the most valuable thing you do this week. The fuel system section of your POH is not optional reading. It is the map to understanding exactly what can go wrong and exactly what to do when it does. Information today came from the National Transportation Safety Board's General Aviation Accident Studies, the Pilot's Operating Handbooks for the Cessna 172 and Piper Cherokee Series, and the FAA's Airplane Flying Handbook. More at radiohanger.com. Thanks for flying traffic pattern. Know your selector positions. Switch your tanks before you have to.